Dean Bagent-Mercer. Good evening, kia ora.
Well, Mario, how's it going, Karen?
Oh, we're all alone here. The RNZ Christmas party. We weren't invited.
Oh, that's a bit mean.
I know. We couldn't go, put it that way. Someone had to hold the fort.
Yeah, you can't have dead air.
No, that's right. Are you having a Christmas party of your own this year?
Oh, I think it'll be quite a small one because most of the people that I work with are in the main centres, but I'm in the far north, so it's going to be a lonely, probably, but delightful Christmas party on the beach by myself.
Very nice. A little mince pie all on your own.
Something like that.
All right, so you're coming out of the forest, actually out of the bush today. You want to go to the beach?
Indeed. I thought, let's flip this thing on its head and talk about the kelp forests, which are also native forests of Aotearoa. They are the rainforests of the sea, of the coastal areas that grow from the rocks, from the reefs, and how dense they used to be and plentiful, just as the forests used to be on the land.
And are they no longer?
Well, not like they used to be, that's for sure. I thought we could go back in time and look at how things have changed around the country, and particularly around the North Island, where when commercial crayfishing started in the 1920s, crayfish was so common, people would walk down to rock pools, and they just, at low tide, they just find the feelers, pick the crayfish up and put them in wheelbarrows and walk off with them.
What? And what years are we talking here?
That was 1920, literally 100 years ago.
Gee, doesn't seem that long ago. Yeah.
No, not at all. And so the oceans around us used to be incredibly plentiful. And in the 1960s, people used to shoot tuna, bluefin and yellowfin tuna, off the beaches as they were migrating up the east coast of the country. People in Hokianga used to just grab over the side of rocks to get crayfish and just have a hook and flip up a snapper. So the sea used to be really full. There used to be workups all around the place, which is where the sea kind of boils as the large fish are chasing up and attacking the small fish that can't get away, and it makes the top of the water sort of shimmer and boil, and then you get the seabirds diving in from above. And that, in the Bay of Islands where I am at the moment, there used to be, that was normal to have hectares and hectares of the sea boiling all at once. And now it's a very rare thing. So since the 1950s, and particularly in the 60s and 70s, commercial fishing really hit the fish populations very hard around the country. And since the 1960s, the population, the human population of our country has doubled. And in that time, more people have got more boats, and with the sophistication of gear that was created for the commercial industry to find fish to sell in fish and chip shops and export, that technology using fish finders and all sorts of other fancy stuff is now being used by recreational fishers, of which there are many, many more, with many more powerful boats that can go further, and using fish finders to really find the very last fish in the sea. And the impact that has had is the abundance and size of fish, of things like snapper and crayfish, has just got smaller and smaller and smaller. And the different thing about crayfish and snapper compared to us humans is as the female crayfish and snapper get larger, particularly the big fertile females, as they get older, they are able to have more and more children, which is babies, unlike humans, where we peak off. And so the largest crayfish and snapper are more important to the population than the small ones. And so we've fished them down in their size, so that's reduced the ability to reproduce. And the other thing that crayfish and snapper can do, because they have big mouths when they're really big, large adults, is they eat kina. They bite into them and you know, snapper love the insides of kina and scoffing them. But when you haven't got kina with large mouths, then kina don't really have many predators, and so they plague. Their populations go out of control, and what they eat is kelp. the native kelp forests. And so they have literally eaten kelp forests down to rock all over the country. And so you need to go deeper and further to find kelp forests. And so the rock pools in those areas that people would normally go to have become less and less full of interesting life over our lifetimes. So that's kind of the context for what's been happening.
Right. Yeah, and kind of amazing that big snapper can eat them, because they obviously must have quite, you know, the inside of their mouths can't be too sensitive.
No, they've got very powerful jaws. Sometimes when you see a snapper skull on the beach, one of the last things to disintegrate is the lower jaw, because it's so strong.
But they've got spikes on them, haven't they, Kinner?
Oh, yeah, yeah, but that doesn't worry crayfish and snapper. They'll just hoe into them. And you'll see a bit of a feeding frenzy when one of the kinner are popped by the fish. So
that's depressing, so isn't it?
Sorry about that. But we really need to be able to bring our native forests back on the land, and as well as the sea. And what I've noticed up here in the Bay of Islands is there is this amazing area called Maunganui Bay, also known as Deepwater Cove. And that has had fishing closed off 12 years ago. And so I remember going snorkeling there 12 years ago and thinking, well, this is pretty boring. There's nothing much left. It's a bit of a wasteland here. And last summer I was there, so that's 12 years, 11 years later, and the kelp forests have returned. They're at least a metre high. There's all sorts of fish in there. There's leather jackets, the snapper fishing round, swimming round. And you can see that the forests want to live under the sea and the life return. We just need to give it a break.
Has it just been that, Dean, just the fact that it's been left alone?
Yeah, just the fact that people aren't removing fish from there. And so that means that the snapper get large enough to eat the kinner. And so the kinner numbers are reducing back to a natural level. And the kelp forests, those leathery kelps, get to come away and go back to where they used to be, time immemorial.
So what hope is there for the rest of the country in relation to that? Or what's being done, from a governmental level in regard to getting these kelp forests back into good health?
Well, we're all a bit slow. And it's all a bit of a tangle in terms of legislation. There's been lots of attempts to protect areas all around the country for decades, and we've made so little progress, it hasn't been funny. But last week, there was a significant legal case won by the Environmental Law Society, which, and the outcome of it, upshot of it, was that for when the Minister of Fisheries makes decisions about crayfish and how much a caught, they have to take into the impact that crayfish have in terms of their size and their numbers of eating kinner, and allowing enough crayfish to flourish so they can eat the kinner, so the kelp forest to come back. So it's the first time that I know of that a minister's been told they have to take the broader environment into consideration when they set catch limits for commercial fishing.
Right. And for the rest of us, oftentimes, and perhaps it's always, you have to actually tell people you can't take the amount that you want, because the majority of people will just keep on pillaging, won't they?
Yeah, we really need a culture change throughout the country, just as we've had a massive culture change about predator-free, and there's so many people, it's part of their normal lives to go out, getting rid of rats and stoats and possums and stuff. In this case, the predators are us. It's human beings. And we have this culture of blaming each other. You know, recreational fishers blame commercial. Māori blame Pākehā. Pākehā blame Māori. Everyone blames immigrants. And it's all this kind of finger-pointing blame game. And it's a waste of time, really, because everyone is responsible. And so we actually need to have areas where there's no fishing dotted all around the country, so that particularly in fish breeding areas, so they can replenish the areas around them that are heavily fished.
And enforce it.
Oh, absolutely. There needs to be local enforcement by local people. And what you see in these areas where fishing has been stopped, as you see a local pride and new businesses coming into those areas of snorkeling and, you know, glass bottom boats and stuff, where people, you know, tourism takes off. They're really good for education. And I don't know about you, but I have fun. Whenever I go snorkeling, I want to see stuff. And it's really boring.
Right.
And there's nothing there.
Of course.
And if I go to a place like the Lee Marine Reserve, it's a wonderland full of life. I've been out to the Poor Knights Marine Reserve twice, and it is absolutely mind-blowing. These huge fish will just come up all around you, all sorts of huge snapper and kingfish and all sorts of stuff, and you feel like you're in a wildlife documentary. But we've lost that from our lives because of the overfishing. So we really need a culture change that supports areas where there's no fishing and for them to be plentiful. We kind of need to flip things on its head, really, because at the moment we've got fishing everywhere in tiny little areas like postage stamps, usually out of the public's way, where there's no fishing. We kind of need to flip it so we think about where fishing does happen, is allowed to happen, and protect the other areas. That's the only way we're really going to turn things around in a significant way in our lifetimes.
What about people who just want to eat fish, crayfish and snapper? They you know, what do you say to them? If you're saying to them, you can't fish here any longer, what's the argument you're going to use?
Well, the thing is that you'd have areas where you can't fish and areas where you can fish. And anywhere, the best fishing any fisher knows is around the edge of a marine reserve, because there's the spillover effect of fish and crayfish, all sorts of things. And so the more of those we have, the more successful edge areas there are to fish. But when there's nearly nothing left anywhere and you've got people with sophisticated equipment to find the last fish, then there's actually, we're just fishing ourselves to absolutely a dead end.
Mm. But humans will find that last fish, won't they?
Well, you see it throughout the world and throughout the country, right down to 2 kilometres deep. Yeah, for sure.
Emmett texted to say, crayfish have certainly diminished around where I am in the Hauraki Gulf, but snapper are prolific. I always let big snapper go and I eat the fat young ones.
Well, interesting you should say that about the Hauraki Gulf, because a recent Auckland University study, and I do mean really recent, is showing there's only 4% of crayfish left there. Now, that's really, really dangerous in terms of their breeding ability. You know, you need to have lots of crayfish that come together with eggs and sperm in the water to be able to fertilise, to be able to have a next generation. And when their numbers are so low, it's a crisis point. But fortunately, this weekend on Waiheke Island, there's the launch of the Arohatia Ki Paka Moana, which is Love the Gulf, marine protection campaign that people can go to.
Oh, yeah.
It's at the Piritahi Marae, and it's kicking off, support to protect areas of the Hauraki Gulf, which has been proposed over some time. And it's going to bring all sorts of keen beings together to work together to bring that about.
Where's the, did you say the Piritahi Marae? Is it on Waiheke Island?
Piritahi Marae, that's correct.
Piritahi, right, got it. And what, people can go along and find out what's going
from
on?
10, from 10 o'clock this Sunday, there's going to be all sorts of people with all sorts of knowledge and guest speakers on what's been happening in the Gulf and what kind of proposals there are. There's proposals at the moment to stop bottom trawling in certain areas, to protect certain areas with marine reserves and whatnot. And so you'll be able to meet some of the specialists there, some of the knowledge holders about all sorts of different fish species and what goes on under the waves.
Bruce's text to say, Karen, I know that fishing ranges in a number of areas where poaching is common are threatened with violence. Until enforcement is taken seriously, the problem won't go away. And that is very true. I worked on a program called Coast Watch years ago, and it's just horrendous what goes on, what the rangers have to deal with.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I see the arrogance and selfishness of people taking too much all the time. And it breaks my heart. This is part of the culture change that we need. And I'm seeing some of it coming through schools, because there's these great programs called Experiencing Marine Reserves up here, where adults will take classes of kids out to areas where there isn't any protection, and they go there and they see that there's pretty much nothing left. And then they take them to a marine reserve, and the kids' minds get completely blown with all these great things that are swimming all around them. And they get to think about what kind of future they want to see in their area with the sea. And getting kids to realise that abundance can be a beautiful and wonderful thing as part of that intergenerational change that will help things.
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it. What about the South Island and the fishing reserves, you know, or the fishing stock around the South?
Well, that's not in great shape either. I'm not saying it's happily ever after down south at all. There's a series of marine reserves down the west coast of the South Island, but they're mainly away from where people live. It's pretty rough on the west coast, of course. And there's a marine reserve in Banks Peninsula. But there's been proposals to have some protected or rahui tapu or no-take areas down near Dunedin. And that negotiation and bartering has been going on for years and years and just keeps reaching deadlocks. And it's a great shame because every month, every year, every season that's missed is a year where is the time when that sea doesn't recover and the local people don't get the benefits from that. So, yeah, it's a hard game. But the sea is depending on us humans taking the pressure off for it to recover, for us to be able to enjoy it more fully.
And what about just the things like eating fish, canned fish, buying smoked salmon, that sort of thing? Any advice there in terms of how we should perhaps reduce our intake of fish?
Yeah, well, if you see a film, a documentary like Seaspiracy, the message is pretty clear that avoiding eating fish is probably the easiest way to have a positive impact on the ecosystem, the marine, what happens under the sea. And, you know, we can get protein from all sorts of other means. So reducing how much you eat in terms of fish is one of the key ways that you can contribute.
Very good. Thank you very much, Dean. Do you eat fish?
I do occasionally, yeah.
What's your favourite?
Oh, well, Mum always used to make cook up gurnard for fish and chips when I was a kid, and I really like that.
But gurnard, I don't is it great? That's underrated, gurnard, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a beautiful fish. But, you know, I'd have it maybe once a year, if that. That's how much we kind of need to reel things back.
Yeah, good on you. Thank you very much, Dean. Good to talk to you. Thank you for that reminder, timely reminder. Thank you.
Awesome. Good night.
Yep, see you later. And happy Christmas, because I probably won't talk to you before next year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, summer.
You too. Thank you so much for talking to us this year. I really enjoyed talking to Dean. That's Dean Bagent-Mercer. And thanks. He's our forest correspondent, but he was talking about the kelp forests.